multiple parentheses, or the echo, as it sometimes is referred to, is a practice used by some anti-Semites on social media. It usually consists of three pairs of parentheses or brackets used around someone's name, and it's a signal to others that the person in question is Jewish. That is where we begin this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The echo was used in the very first tweet that set off a barrage of anti-Semitic slurs from anonymous trolls that were directed at Jonathan Weissman. He is deputy Washington editor of the New York Times, working on the Times' coverage of Congress. His new book out this month is called Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. And the word Semitism has an echo. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you readily admit that the whole impetus for writing your book was this onslaught of attacks on Twitter, some attacks persisting today. Why were people going after you?
Well, it all started in August of 2016. May 2016. There was a columnist for the Washington Post, a guy named Robert Kagan from the Brookings Institution, had written a column called "This Is How Fascism Comes to America." It was during the Republican primaries, and Donald Trump was really gaining steam. He really was unstoppable at that point. I had taken a piece of that column and put it out on Twitter with a link, and I got a notation back, as you said, that just said it was from @CyberTrump, and it just came back saying, "Hello, Weissman," with my name in those three parentheses. And when I said, "Care to explain?" he came back and he said, "What ho, the vaunted Ashkenazi intelligence. It was a dog whistle. I was belling the cat for my fellow Goyim." And with that belling, as you said, the putting of the echoes around my name, I was treated to an onslaught of some of the most ugly anti-Semitism that I had ever seen.
Through your book, you have to relive this story again and again and again. Why go through this? Why do that?
I mean, you know, it's interesting because at the time, and I was getting all this stuff, and I would kind of send it out into the world by retweeting it, and I wanted to show people what was out there, what had been stirred up by the ugliness of the presidential campaign. And I'm still trying to do that because I think that what I'm worried about is this complacency. Now, after Charlottesville, I think the country got a big slap in the face wake-up call. But I feel like a lot of people still do not really understand how much kind of ugliness is out there and how the guardrails on what is and is not acceptable in American conversation right now have come off.
How did you know how to when your line was crossed? I mean, how did you know this was vicious abuse and not just some people trying to provoke you on Twitter?
Yeah, and then, you know, to this day, this is a big argument because obviously they really do love to provoke it. That's their big thing. We're trying to trigger the Jews or African Americans or Muslim Americans. They're into that. But I think, you know, once we started seeing actually this hatred jumping from the internet into real life, I think we should all realize that we're dealing with something bigger here. I mean, remember, this is an international movement. The Polish parliament just passed a law saying that it is illegal to suggest that the Poles had anything to do with the Holocaust. You know, you have Golden Dawn, a white nationalist movement in Greece. Viktor Orban, the president of Hungary, just won a smashing re-election by running against George Soros in what was basically a blatantly anti-Semitic campaign. Marine Le Pen was the runner-up to the French presidency, and her National Front is an overtly racist organization. So I think that we are in an era right now of rising nationalism that has this undertone of bigotry, and it's an infection that's sweeping the globe right now.
And you bring this worldview to the conversation of what you're talking about here, where you know, people governed by crushing ideas or people who oppose authoritarian leaders. And former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has a new book out on that topic. And she was born in Czechoslovakia. Her family fled after the Nazis occupied the country in 1939. And let's hear a moment from her interview earlier this week on NPR's Fresh Air.
Because so many of the things that have happened and happened in Czechoslovakia were steps that came as a result of ethnic issues with the German minority, but mostly steps that seemed not so terrible that there couldn't be a deal made. And so that's what's so worrisome, is that these fascism can come in a way that it is one step at a time and in many ways then goes unnoticed until it's too late.
Do people who are Jewish see the warning signs you identify?
I actually feel like most American Jews aren't really watching. I actually have a whole chapter in the book, which I call the Israel Diversion, about how mainline American Jewish organizations have become so obsessed with the ins and outs of what's happening in Israel that we've lost sight of what's happening in the United States. So like Madeleine Albright says, I think that even Jewish Americans are not really watching closely what is happening in this country.
We're talking right now with Jonathan Weissman. He's deputy Washington editor of the New York Times. His new book out this month is called Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you Jewish? Do you encounter people who make assumptions about you because of your faith? What misconceptions do you want to dispel? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Jonathan, we've had a number of conversations here in WPR and nationally as we saw a more visible group who call themselves the alt-right. You bring up Charlottesville. We usually talk about race, but what effect does that belief system have on Jewish people living here in America?
I mean, I think that you know, this movement of the alt-right is predicated in some ways on, well, it's a white nationalist movement. They have this idea that the United States should be a ethno-state devoted to white supremacy, basically a safe zone for white people. They don't define Jews as white. They say Jews they're not white. They've created a kind of a pantheon of hate in which Muslim Americans and African Americans and Latinos and immigrants and Jews are all put together in this structure where the Jews are the puppet masters who are running this whole enterprise in which African Americans and Muslims and other brown-skinned people are replacing white people. That's where that chant, Jews will not replace us, comes from. And it puts us all in, basically, we're all in this together in that sense.
And you talk in your book about a language that these so-called alt-right members use. What words did you discover, and what's the significance of their popularity?
You know, there's all sorts of hidden code. The other day, there was this melee in Huntington Beach, California, where there was a pro-Trump demonstration, and anti-Trump demonstrators showed up, and they actually got into this huge fight on the beach. And I saw this guy holding a sign that said, "De Goyim no." Now, nobody in the world knows what "De Goyim no," except me, because I studied this stuff. And it's actually short for "the Goyim know, shut it down," which is this idea that Jews are actually controlling the world through this nefarious plot. And if only the non-Jews would recognize and understand the plot, we, the Jews, would have to shut it down. Mm. There are all these other words. Now we call special snowflakes. if we protest the rising language of hate, then we're just snowflakes who are too overly sensitive. There's so many of these words out there right now. And, you know, it's funny, Wisconsin, I'm glad to talk to you guys because Wisconsin has become this strange part of this because Paul Neelan, and the guy who's running for the Republican nomination in Wisconsin won, the first district, has become a figure in this. Mm. You know, remember, he ran against Paul Ryan 2 years ago.
And let's pause right there with Paul Neelan. And the book is Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. Jonathan Weissman stays with us. You can call in 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. New York Times editor Jonathan Weissman was inundated by anti-Semitic tweets after he posted about an article called This is How Fascism Comes to America. He's out with a new book that takes more of a global perspective, a step back to view the larger context of the white nationalist movement and its connections to the Trump administration, and before that, the Trump campaign. We're exploring it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is called Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. And you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. How do you think the internet changes people's actions? Does it encourage anti-Semitism and other discrimination? Or is attacking someone online just another avenue of hate that you see in other places in our culture? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, where we left off the conversation, we are talking about Paul Ryan's, House Speaker Paul Ryan's seat, where Paul Neelan is running for the Republican nomination. He's been described, he describes himself as a pro-white Christian American running for the Republican nomination, and he was booted off of Twitter.
I'm interested in Paul Neelan because when Paul Neelan ran for this seat in the Republican primary 2 years ago, he ran basically as a standard conservative Republican. And, you know, his attacks on Paul Ryan was that Ryan was too cozy with Washington and was not conservative enough. And he only got like 20% of the vote. He's remaking himself as kind of an avatar of the alt-right, an outright anti-Semite and an outright racist. And now I'm not suggesting that he is going to get more of the vote in Wisconsin's first district, but he's become a national figure because of his remake. He's now a much more prominent person because of his embrace of the alt-right.
Do you think that shutting him down on Twitter is appropriate, or would that make any impact at all?
I think it actually does have an impact. I mean, Twitter is not a bastion of the First Amendment. Twitter is a corporation. And when you sign up for Twitter or for Facebook or for most social media platforms, you have to sign terms of service. And that those terms of service say you cannot use this platform to attack based on race, sexual orientation, ethnic origin, religion. So, you know, it's not a free-for-all. You have rules, and Twitter actually if it's going to have the rules, is obliged to enforce those rules. And that's what it did with Paul Neelan. Of course, Neelan is now trying to use that to rally support and say that he is the oppressed one here. This is a trick of the alt-right, that they want to be the owners of the First Amendment.
And these groups do not target only Jewish people. What's the same or perhaps different when they go after people of this faith?
I mean, I think that, look, one of the things I make clear in the book is that Jews are, first of all, not the only targets. And if you want to measure attacks against Muslim Americans and immigrants have been much more violent, actually homicidal. And I don't want to get into this contest of who has it worse. know, everyone's got it pretty bad in an era where suddenly it's become much more acceptable. In fact, you know, our president talks about political correctness. Well, in some quarters, political correctness means not being a bigot. And if you say, let's not be politically correct, that means I can say anything I want. And some of that has become pretty hateful.
Let's bring in a call now. Sarah is joining us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I feel like I'm a little tuned into the anti-Semitism that I see around me and online because I have a Jewish grandfather. But I have a friend named Trudy who grew up in Nazi Germany, and she's 85 now. And I'm on this online forum called Quora, and someone asked a question on there, what were the kids in Germany taught about during the war as it was happening? And my friend Trudy really wanted to answer that, but she's, like, so tired that I had to help her, so I wrote it for her. And she said that the main thing was that how they just, the government just changed the propaganda that they all experienced. And they were taught in school that Hitler had this childhood that was so great, and he could have done anything in his life, but he discovered that the Jews were trying to take over Germany and that they were trying to take everything away from Germany, from the German people, and that they had to be stopped. And that's what he dedicated his life to, and that is what people believed. And they believed that the Jews had stolen Germany from the German people, and the whole purpose of the war and of Nazism and of Hitler was to take back what had been taken away from them and by the Jews. And she knew some Jewish people when she was a little girl, and she really liked them. They were her friends, and then she saw them, they disappeared, and she asked the adults, what happened to this wonderful man I know? And she was told, he was taken away where he can't hurt German people anymore. And she is very, very worried about Trump ever since the beginning, because she sees this is how things happen in Germany. This is so many things he does, and the way he talks about immigrants and minorities, and it's just, for her, it's like, this is like, it's all happening again. And I see it on Quora. There's the Holocaust denying thing is just really, there's a lot of it on there, and the people who fight back are mostly Jewish people.
Sarah, thank you. Let's get Jonathan to respond.
I think that one of the, I hear from Holocaust survivors a lot too. They're very worried, and I don't think necessarily that they're worried for the Jews so much as they're worried for anybody who has been targeted as the outsider, the other, because I think a lot of the angry rhetoric that they hear coming from the president and the White House has given license to Americans with disaffection to lash out, and I think that's what really echoes. There are Holocaust survivors, people who lived through World War II, who just see have a PTSD moment when they just see the anger out there directed to any kind of ethnic group.
Julie in Milwaukee emailed, and she said, "I find myself afraid to tell people I don't know that I am Jewish. It used to be a no big deal to mention my faith in passing. That's no longer the case." And Julie says, "That saddens me." Jonathan, do you feel like Julie is not alone there in that feeling?
No, I think that one of the reasons that I got involved is in all of this is because I was raised in a not very religious household, in a very reformed synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm so assimilated into American culture that certainly Judaism was not the first, probably not the second or third way I would describe myself. And to be picked out and attacked as a Jew when you have no real outward manifestations of that is scary, because it's a sense like you can run from your Judaism, but they will find it and rub it in your face. I don't think that we should be afraid. I said in the book, I don't think this is a time for fear or diffidence. This is a time actually to stand up and unite with other groups that also are in fear and say, no, we are not afraid. And I feel like a lot of people, one of my own daughters said, I want to change my last name because of all of this. And I think I sympathize, but I hope that we can actually find strength in this moment.
Well, you write about your daughter's path into Judaism and her commitment to ritual, but still you're concerned that people are going through the motions of the faith, but that Jewish people do not have a tangible moral purpose. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that I have two daughters. One is kind of not particularly Jewish identified. The other one, really on her own, became very Jewish identified. And my concern is that, when I was young, there was a lot less Hebrew, a lot less ritual in the synagogue. Now, you go to even the most reformed synagogue, and you see a lot of Hebrew. But what I'm worried about in American Judaism is a disconnection to the spiritual side and the religious side. Now, this came from my own exploration of how to respond to rising hatred and bigotry. And a lot of people I talked to talked about tactics or strategies. And it was only when I talked to my rabbi, Rabbi Daniel Zemel in Washington, who said, you look to the Torah, look to the religious books, and it says, where a Jew can sees injustice, a Jew is to stand up to injustice. And it struck me as amazing that I never thought to look to my actual religion to find answers. And I think that a lot of Jews aren't looking to the religion, to the religious side or the spiritual side of Judaism for answers.
We're talking with Jonathan Weissman. His new book is Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been attacked by people who hate you because of your religion? What happened? What should other people know about the way Jewish families are treated in America today? Have you seen differences since 2016? Call in 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's take a step back here, Jonathan, and look at the age of young people, 14-year-old boys, looking at what this notion of race mixing, and you write about your daughter's response to these online scrawls, using things like Jews are parasites. Other people reading that are really young teenagers. What is the problem with having this younger audience seeing this?
This is one of the things I really worry about. A lot of people ask me, is there more bigotry? Are we just seeing the same old bigotry because we have the internet? But as I talked to one woman, Zoe Quinn, and we can talk about this later if you want, but who was actually a video game designer and a victim of something called Gamergate, these attacks on women video game designers. And she was talking about, teenagers. And if you lie in the filth long enough, eventually you're going to breathe some of it in. Now, the neo-Nazis and the anti-Semites and the bigots, at first, they lived on their own little websites that they created, but then they discovered that if they start spreading their ideology on some of these other mediums like Twitter or 4chan or 8chan or the chat rooms of YouTube, then people will run into it. And a lot of those people that are running into it are teenagers who are being exposed to disaffected youth who are being exposed to hate, and some of whom inevitably will latch onto it.
Chat rooms can also still have a little bit more of a privacy than the wide open, perhaps more of a Wild West exposure of Twitter, where lots of people are in and out, moving through Twitter, seeing things, versus chat rooms. Do you see a difference there?
Well, it's what I see is that Twitter actually, once these online onslaughts against Jewish journalists began promoting it or showing it, and eventually, at first, Twitter resisted doing anything about it, and then eventually kind of swept through, and you see a lot less of it on Twitter because Twitter is now policing its terms of service. But in the chat rooms, like 4chan and 8chan, there's no policing of anything. That's where the Wild West is, and it's really ugly. And I agree that it doesn't have as much exposure to folks like us who don't live our lives in these chat rooms. But a lot of teenagers spend a lot of time posting on these places, and they are seeing it, and that's what worries me.
What is different now that President Trump is in office compared to the times before his candidacy and the 2016 win in terms of these threats and these messages and the following you have had with your thread lines on Twitter?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously the heat of a presidential campaign stirs up a lot, and it's not as heated a moment. But I actually do believe that there's a lot of this still out there. I mean, I have to go look for it now because, as I said, Twitter is policing it pretty well. Facebook has always policed it pretty well. But as soon as I look onto 4chan or 8chan, or if I look at the Daily Stormer website, which is one of the great orchestrators of all of this, oh, it's still very much out there. And I think there was a lot of hope in Donald Trump during the campaign that he would actually be really the alt-right president. And things happen on the campaign trail. In the body politic, that will stir things up too. You know, if President Trump is out there defending the wall or the Muslim ban or things like that, then you start seeing cycles of hatred spewing out on the internet. So it's still very much out there. But as you would expect, we are not in the midst of a campaign yet, and so it's a little cooler.
Do the president's decisions related to Israel make an impact on Jewish people, do you think, and this language that is out there?
That's a good question, and I talk about this in the book as well. I kind of divide Jews, American Jews, into two groups, the tribalists and the internationalists. And the tribalists, who are more conservative, more Orthodox in their religion, they like Trump. They really love Donald Trump because their primary concern is Israel. And they're willing to look beyond the attendant racism and anti-Semitism and bigotry in Trump's supporters because Donald Trump is very pro-Israel. He's not pressing Israel to negotiate peace. He's not pressing Israel to make any concessions. And he's done this one big thing, promising to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. To the tribalist Jews, this is good enough to justify anything else.
It's like an offset in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's
pause right there with Jonathan Weissman. The book is Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are you thinking about as you hear this discussion? Have you been attacked by people who hate you because of your Jewish religion? What happened? How do you deal with it? Let's talk about it right after this news here on the Ideas Network. The Jewish community needs to do something to address the influx of hate directed toward this group, and Jewish organizations aren't prepared to address the bigotry. That's one of the calls to action that Jonathan Weissman makes in his new book, Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. We're exploring the book on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 2 years ago, Jonathan Weissman tweeted about an article about the rise of fascism in America becoming the target of neo-Nazi attacks on Twitter. You can call in with your questions, your reflections, 800-642-1234. How do you think the internet changes people's actions? Does it encourage anti-Semitism and other discrimination? Or is attacking someone online just another avenue of hate that you see in other places in our culture? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jonathan, some people hearing this program, this topic, this conversation, and they'll think this is just anti-Trump. Is that an intention here? Is that missing a point?
Now, there are certain lines that the political establishment, the political parties of the United States are not supposed to cross. And this is not liberal or conservative. It's not Republican or Democratic. The fact is that we are a pluralist democracy, and our politics are not supposed to espouse bigotry or racism or anti-Semitism. I hear this a lot, that that people can't speak out against rising bigotry because somehow it will be perceived as anti-Trump. And I really want to push back on that and say, look, this is not about whether you're for or against the president. This is about whether you're for or against American institutions like the First Amendment and the Constitution and law and the rule of law. You know, to stand for pluralism, to stand for democracy, should not be a partisan political act.
Let's bring in Sam joining us from Merrill. Hi, Sam.
I'm married to a Islander, and you know, I just have noticed within the last probably 8 years. Just for instance, I was attacked at a campground by a guy who was yelling names at me that I'm a liberal. Apparently, he assumed I was a liberal because I'm married to somebody who's not white, which I'm not a liberal, but. I mean, I don't care what you are, liberal or whatever, but everybody's got their point. But I just noticed a lot, there's just a lot of anger, you know, and it seems to be, what I see is white people, a lot of white men feel very oppressed right now. The wages are very stagnant, and yet when they turn on the liberal side, the liberals are never bringing this up, so they're getting just, like, more angry. So that was my comment. Thank you.
Sam, thanks. Jonathan, there is a lot of anger out there.
Right. I mean, I'm glad Sam mentioned this because there is frustration. I think there is real frustration with what's happening with wages and jobs. And even though we live in a now low unemployment economy, we haven't seen wages recover. And I think there's a lot of frustration, especially among white men who do feel like their perch in the American economy is feeling very, very weakened. And they're looking to lash out. I mean, as Sam said, look, he's not a liberal because he has a wife who's not white. But somehow, even being associated with somebody who doesn't look like you is somehow a political statement. And I find that very sad because, you know, we're not supposed to be making political statements by who we associate with.
Jonathan, in recent times, there have been attacks on Jewish community centers, certainly in the Milwaukee area as well. How have synagogues, rabbis responded to this hatred?
That's a good question, because I think that you've seen responses at the local level, at the synagogue level, and with smaller Jewish organizations that are very instructive. I talk in the book about an organization called NOAH in Nashville, which is an umbrella organization of synagogues and black churches and white churches and Muslim organizations that are trying to stand together against bigotry and for social justice causes. And I think that this kind of thing is happening in a lot of places. But what I don't see it happening enough on a large enough scale. Because I think that alliance actions are best. If you stand up as a Jew against anti-Semitism, you're always going to have somebody saying either, well, it's not that bad against you guys, or you're just trying to promote yourselves. But if you stand together with African-Americans and Muslims or Latinos and say we are standing against bigotry and hatred in general, it's much harder to accuse you of self-promotion. And I think that that is beginning to happen.
Let's bring in Randy to the conversation. Randy is joining us from Madison. Hi there, Randy.
Good morning. As my father used to say, may you always be blessed by stupid enemies. And what I've started to notice in some discourse is that you were dealing with people who were very dedicated anti-Semites, but I find myself hearing other people who, you know, don't have actual malicious motives, but they just make assumptions. The other day I heard somebody talking about how the pro-Israel stances, come from American media because, of course, it's all owned by Jews. And things like that are, you know, they're as evil as the usual anti-Semitism, but the fact that people don't actually know there's a very evil heritage behind it seems to make it more part of the discourse.
Randy, thank you for the call. Evil heritage, Jonathan?
I think that is, first of all, one of the interesting things about this new version of anti-Semitism is how old it is. They present, the alt-right presents itself like hipsters, and they are, obviously technologically savvy. They know how to get their message out on modern social media, but their message itself is very old, this notion of Jews running everything and controlling and having some kind of central organization. It goes back to the fraudulent protocols of the Elders of Zion and the great plot to run the world. Jews are kind of have an interesting part in all of this because in a lot of the country, white people see immigrant communities, Muslim communities, African Americans around them, and they feel like somehow they're being threatened by these communities. They don't necessarily see Jews or recognize Jews, but that ignorance, that sense of not knowing who Jews are, lends itself to this paranoia, that sense that that vulnerability to the notion that Jews are somehow orchestrating the rise of the other in this country.
Jonathan, going back to the 2016 election, we heard Russian President Vladimir Putin suggest that Jews might have been behind attacks, behind attempts to hack the American vote. Why would Putin target the Jewish people? What do you make of that?
That, again, is ancient and modern. Russia has always been a fount of anti-Semitism. In fact, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, this document that won't die, even though it has been proven a forgery, came out of Russia. And this notion that the Jews could be behind any plot has always resurfaced. Of course, it's very helpful for Vladimir Putin to have some other people to blame for whatever. And in this case, blaming Jews for the Russian interference in our election is quite convenient, since Jews are, in the United States, predominantly Democratic. It makes no sense to us in America. Why in the world would the Jews be behind the hacking of the election? But I think to Putin's audience in Russia, that makes perfect sense. Oh, yeah, it was the Jews that must have done it.
So, Jonathan, whose responsibility is to fix the issues that we're identifying here? How do you remedy this?
That is a very difficult question because, you know, the fact of the matter is you knock things down, it pops back up. Paul Neelan was kicked off of Twitter, but if you go and look on Twitter now for Paul Neelan, you'll see about 100 Paul Neelans because it's like whack-a-mole. You whack something down and something else comes back up. In some ways, you need to fight rising bigotry with a counter of acceptance. And there's not, it's not enough to just try to silence the bigots. It doesn't really work. You actually have to do a counteroffensive to try to get Americans back on the track of being more accepting and a more open society.
Is the counteroffensive that you put together, would you consider that to be your book?
You know, I'm an editor at the New York Times. I'm not a social activist. I'm not a community organizer. So, yes, in that sense, I have put out a book which is something of a wake-up call and a call to arms, but I can't now go out there and organize Americans for pluralism and tolerance. I think Americans have to do that for ourselves.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Weissman. He's deputy Washington editor of the New York Times. He's a writer and author. His new book that came out a couple weeks ago, it's called Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Cheryl Gasser is director of the Ideas Network. Michelle Johnson, executive producer of Mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.